So, welcome. Thank you very much. And thank you for that extremely kind introduction, John. I really appreciate that. So, John is a good friend, which always helps. So, tonight's topic, as you knew when you got in here, is who were the Essenes? And a great deal of what you may know or think you know about the Essenes could well be wrong. But you're in good company because a lot of what scholars know or think they know about the Essenes could also be wrong. And get into some of that. We may not get into all of it because it gets very intricate, but there are a lot of mysteries and misconceptions. But let's start with the time frame we're talking about tonight, which is 200 BC to 200 AD. And this was a time when Judea, where the Essenes lived, the land of the Jews, present-day Israel, was, for the most part, under the thumb of various foreign powers. For most of this time, it was Rome. And as we will see, their relations with Rome were not exactly pleasant much of the time, if any of the time. You'll also notice that since it's BC to AD, the life of Christ, or the birth of Christ, falls just about in the middle of this, which leads us to the question of whether Jesus had any connection with the Essenes, because since, of course, he was born in this area. And I will get to that, but not right now. To begin with, there were three Jewish sects at the time. You may have, if you're familiar with the Bible, you've come across these because Jesus is always arguing with the Pharisees in the Gospels. And he does argue also with the Sadducees in the Gospels. Whether they're actually mentioned in the New Testament at all, these Essenes, is again another question that we're not going to get to right yet. But since we're not going to bother with the Pharisees and Sadducees tonight, because you didn't come to hear a lecture about the Pharisees and Sadducees, we will focus on the Essenes. Now, what does the name mean? And, you know, this is really the answer. Nobody really knows. I mean, here are two educated guesses. And the first one, maybe from the Greek hazioi, holy. Well, the Greek for Essenes is esenoi, hazioi. Does that really sound that close? Not really. Another variant of their name in Greek was Essaioi. That sounds a little more like Hazioi, but it still isn't really that great. And Philo of Alexandria, who's the one who came up with this idea, doesn't seem entirely convinced by it himself. This is a little more plausible. The Hebrew Osei HaTorah, doers of the law. And that's a little better, because this is what's known as a construct form in Hebrew, which you don't need to bother with. But the non-construct form is osim. It's a plural. And so osim and esenoi sound a little bit more like each other. To me, that's the most plausible one I've come across yet, but I don't think any scholar is like really 100% happy with any of the things that have come up. And there are various others, you know. So it might have something to do with holy. Another idea is that it might have something to do with a word that possibly means holy in Aramaic, except they never found that particular word in the Aramaic of that period. Well, here too, where do they come from? Nobody really knows. They appear, they start to appear around 100 BC, again in Judea. They did claim ancient origins, but it's not really exactly clear what these origins were or what they go back to. One possibility is the Greek philosophical schools. Now, the Greek philosophical schools were not like, say, the philosophy departments of a university today, which is good because nobody would be have the slightest interest in them. They were to some degree or another like esoteric schools or communities. The most famous were the Pythagoreans, followers of Pythagoras, who lived in the 6th century BC. And they had communities. They would study the teachings of Pythagoras, the idea, his geometric theories, as well as his cosmic theories. And they, I believe, practiced celibacy for reasons we'll get to. So we're talking about something in between, like kind of a monastery and an esoteric school. There were no real monasteries in those days in the West. These Greek philosophical schools are, in a way, their ancestors. And we'll see that the Essenes have some features that are like both these schools and monasteries. Sometimes, if you read about them, even by highly qualified scholars, they will make it sound really like a monastery. The Essene community is really like a monastery. And you have to take this with some lightness, because some of the scholars are Catholic monks, and naturally they're going to look at something like this like a Catholic monastery. They may be overstating the similarities sometimes. But there are some. There are some. What did they practice? Well, here's one that I've already gotten to: communal living. They lived in communities of, I don't know exactly the size. I think Josephus, who's a historian of the period, said that there were like 4,000 Essenes in Judea, various communities of one sort or another. As that quote from Josephus says, if you had to give up your money when you came in, nobody had any money. Everybody worked at what they did. If they lived in the community itself, it was somewhat monastic in that way. Sometimes they lived in communities and worked outside, and they brought their wages in, and they had some manager take care of it. They didn't live very fancy lives, and wealth and the accoutrements of luxury and pleasure were things, like many of the Greek philosophical schools, that they despised, looked down on. They thought it was like unworthy of a person to be, so preoccupied with this, which makes it kind of pretty much a mirror image of the United States in 2014, which is where it's very hard to think that anybody would be concerned about anything else. So they worked, they led very simple lives, very regular lives. And Josephus says an interesting thing about them. Well, because their lives are so simple and so regular, many of them live past the age of 100. So I don't know, that's what Josephus said. I mean, he lived at the time of the Essenes. It's not, legends from hundreds of years later. He was familiar with these communities, probably studied with the Essenes at some point. So he says a lot of them lived to past 100. I mean, we have to take him, to some degree at face value. Minus all the wonderful Western medical care that we get. Celibacy. Scorning wedlock, they select other men's children while still pliable and teachable and fashion them after their own pattern. Now, that was, so basically, you either join the Essenes as an adult, or maybe if you were an orphan, the Essenes might take you in and raise you as an Essene. The medieval monks did the same thing, as a matter of fact. Most of them were celibate, most. And again, their reasons for celibacy were not quite like what the later Christian reasons were. They didn't so much think of sex in itself as evil, but they did regard getting involved with women and having to raise children and all that, sometimes disagreeable stuff, as interference with a serious spiritual life. And again, that was something they had in common with the Greek philosophic schools. Now, this is not, for one thing, that is not a very Jewish thing. The Jews have never practiced or advocated celibacy to any great degree, which again is why I'm saying there might be some influence from these Greek schools. The first commandment of the Torah, as Jews often point out, is go be fruitful and multiply. And that's taken seriously enough so that, you're just, a rabbi, whatever, still expected to marry and have children. So this was very un-Jewish in a certain sort of way. Not all Essenes were celibate, as a matter of fact. Some of them did marry. Did not have a rather particularly high opinion of the female sex. I won't even go into that. If you were going to marry an Essene, a woman had to go through like a 3-year probation, and intercourse was only for the sake of procreation. Again, for reasons like this, you know, this attachment to worldly life. This is important, as we shall see. They do not venture to remove any utensil or go and ease themselves. That's what it sounds like. They didn't go to the bathroom on the Sabbath. And that's taking the seventh day commandment pretty seriously. One theory that's advanced is that, well, for the sake of ritual purity or cleanliness, the place you had to go and relieve yourself, you got a little kind of axe or entrenching tool when you were in a scene. You were supposed to dig a hole and cover yourself while you're, taking your ease so as not to offend the eyes of the sun. This is also in Josephus. And probably the distance was farther than you were allowed to travel on the Sabbath, which was a day of rest. So you couldn't go anywhere where you could actually go to the bathroom. So how they actually managed that, I don't know. I suspect they probably avoided eating very much on Friday. But the point of that is that they were very, very observant of the law. Of the three sects, you know, that we started with, they were probably the most observant and the most rigorous about it, which is a key part of the story. This is possible. I was reading a book by one scholar and said, well, there's no real reason to believe that the Essenes were pacifists, but there is this. You know, they refused to make any weapons of war. They would, if they were present-day investors, they would not invest in munitions companies and that kind of thing, and they would not, in those days, make anything that would contribute to war. They even avoided doing things that were commercial. They would not go into like ship owning or anything like that because they felt that kind of greed encouraged war. So they were very, very strict about what they did. And it's hard for me to believe that they weren't pacifists if that's really the way they felt. So that seems likely to me. And then there are the mystical practices. All of these details I'm pointing out to you will be important in our story, but they seem to have various kinds of predictions of the future, dream interpretation, which I don't know, I may get into that a little bit, but basically they had these mystical powers, and it says, rarely, if ever, do their predictions prove wrong, which very, very few other prophets can claim that, whether you're Nostradamus or the Bible prophets of the Old Testament or various other things, but that's another lecture. So they had these mystical practices. And this, Philo, whom I referred to earlier, said they had a life of perfect freedom, which in a way is true, and in a way it isn't true. Obviously, if you're not allowed to go to the bathroom, it's not on Saturday, it's not really quite what we think of as a life of perfect freedom. But on the other hand, if your life is like actually fairly rigidly organized, all your needs are taken care of, you don't have a family to worry about. If they did have a family, the ones who married had the children taken care of by the community. They took very, very good care of old people, so you had no worries about your old age. So life was, it was not exactly glamorous, but since they didn't want life to be glamorous, that was okay. And this kind of philosophical detachment, this kind of ability to spend the time contemplating the law, particularly in practicing the law, was their goal in life. And so that leads me to what I think is the most plausible theory of their origins, which is that at some point somebody, we don't really know who, looked at these Greek philosophical schools, a Jew looked at these Greek philosophical schools and said, you know, that looks kind of good in some ways. Why don't we do something like that, but devote ourselves to our own law? And that would explain it reasonably well, although the origins of that, who did that exactly when, are not very well known, or not known at all. Here's an interesting... Now, if you remember back to the three sects, the Sadducees appear in the New Testament, and they get into arguments with Jesus because the Sadducees believe not in the resurrection. That's what it says in the Gospels. And the reason the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection is because it's not in the Hebrew Bible, except maybe a little bit in the book of Daniel, which is the absolute latest of all the biblical Hebrew Bible's books. There's not really much about the afterlife in the Judaism, the Old Testament. Very, very little. And what there is makes it, you know, it's sort of like the Greek Hades. You go down to the shadowy underworld, which is kind of this miserable place, and you kind of fade away. But the Essenes do not believe that. The souls remain immortal forever. If the soul is good, the Essenes said, it would go to this kind of beatific western island far off in the distance where the climate was perfect and there was no more suffering. If the soul wasn't good, it went down to, guess what we would think of as hell. And when Josephus mentions this, he says, well, this is very much like the teachings of the Greeks. Well, it was particularly the teachings of the Greek mystery schools, particularly the Orphics, O-R-P-H-I-C-S, followers of the legendary Orpheus, who believed pretty much like what I just told you. And so it's interesting to see, well, okay, this is a still very Jewish, but you have a lot of influence from the Greek philosophical and mystery schools coming in. Somehow, we don't really know how. Their belief in the afterlife. Also, notice, you're starting to see things like here. Well, celibacy, kind of this heaven and hell thing, kind of a denial of sexuality. This is starting to look like Christianity. And the connections between the Essenes and Christianity are... intriguing, like everything else, they're difficult to sort out, and it's full of misinformation about it. Well, here's the bad version of the afterlife, which is this is the classic Sisyphus carrying the stone up the hill, only to have it roll down again and live a life of eternal frustration. Let's go into the history. I said it started. The period we're talking about, starts in the 2nd century BC, that is the 100s BC. And this man was not an Essene, Judas Maccabeus, but he was a very important figure because the Greek king of Syria kind of walked into Judea and not only took over everything, but started to persecute the Jewish religion. He put an altar and maybe an image of Zeus in the Jerusalem temple, which was a horrible thing to do. And the Jews didn't like this, as you can imagine, so they revolted. And they drove out this king, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and started the Hasmonean dynasty. There was a little bit of breathing room. The Seleucid Empire, which was the one that was oppressing the Jews, was in decline, and the Roman Republic, as it still was, was not yet in that area. So there was a little breathing room for the Jews, and they had a more or less independent state under the Hasmonean dynasty, the descendants actually of Judas Maccabeus' brother. And this is a coin, I think, from one of them. I think it's Alexander. One of them was named Alexander. I think this says Alexander. The resolution, sorry, isn't very good. But the thing you need to know about the Hasmoneans for tonight's purposes is chiefly that they and the Essenes seem to hate each other. The Essenes really did not get along with the Hasmoneans, largely because, probably with some accuracy, they thought the Hasmoneans were vicious and corrupt. I mean, these were Jewish kings, but you know, you can be nasty to your own people as well, or better, as you can be nasty to anybody else. And the Hasmoneans, shall we say, chose their friends wrong. They tried to make themselves independent of Rome, and the Romans didn't do it. They threw the Hasmoneans out and put wicked King Herod in, who's certainly the most powerful and impressive figure in this entire period in terms of Jewish rulers. He's famous for something he probably didn't do, which was kill all the little babies in Bethlehem after Jesus was born. Very few serious scholars believe that that's anything more than a legend. If you call up, you know, a New Testament professor at some reputable seminary or divinity school and ask him if he believed in the massacre of the innocents, he's almost certain to say no, for reasons that are like another lecture. But although it wouldn't have been out of character for him, they just don't think he would have happened to do this. And Herod, remember when I said earlier that the Essenes were skilled in prophecy and dream interpretation, that kind of thing? Well, it turned out that during this period, an Essene named Menachem or Menaimus told Herod he would become king before he actually was king, a prophecy which came true. And Herod, after that point, was very, 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 very good to the Essenes. They were oppressed and hated by the Hasmoneans, but Herod treated them very, very well. And this is also a part of the story. In fact, not every scholar believes this, but this makes the most sense to me. I mean, I'm certainly not going to give you, there's no time to give you theories I disagree with or, you know, just feel to some degree I've been discredited. There just isn't time, and it would be confusing anyway, right? I'm just telling you what I think is most likely, what, you know, reasonable scholarship thinks is most likely. All right, well, here, this is the Dead Sea. Hey, here's a trivia question. Why is the year 2030 important and relevant to the Dead Sea? Any guesses? It is the year in which, at the current rate of depletion, the Dead Sea will cease to exist. The mighty river Jordan here, in which Jesus was baptized, is something more or less a trickle, not a very clean trickle. So all of this is just drying up. They have resorts that used to be on the seashore in the Dead Sea, and now they have to bus people from the resort to the actual seashore. Just to put it in, those of you who haven't find this interesting, which it is in a disturbing way, up here is Qumran. And the theory that makes the most sense to me is that this area here was apparently a royal domain. And it is possible that Herod, who very much liked the Essenes, gave them some chunk of this territory, the northwestern Dead Sea, to use as their own. This is desert, right? This is not exactly lush terrain. And this is Qumran. And there's a little cave there. And they had a community there. One thing they did was they prepared medicinal herbs, wines, medicinal date honey. I don't know what they used date honey for medicinally, but they apparently thought it was good for something. And they did something else there. They preserved old scrolls. Now, the Jews are different from the Christians in this, that Christians would burn a text that they considered heretical. They would just toss it into the fire. The Jews wouldn't do that because they reasoned that even a heterodox text actually has divine names written in it, so it can't be desecrated. You can't just like put it down in the recycling bin. Something a little bit more thoughtful had to be done with it. So they put them in these scroll jars and created a geniza, which is basically kind of a cemetery for scrolls and texts. This one, I think, is the one in Cairo. The most famous one is in Cairo, and it's not a burial place. It's like a fake wall that had just been in the synagogue, and people literally for centuries, instead of burying the scrolls, they would just throw them there and, you know, get around to burying them someday. About 100 years ago, someone found them, and this is like, you know, a treasure trove of medieval Jewish manuscripts, all because they never got around to burying them. That is probably what the Essenes were doing with the scrolls at Qumran, which you may better know as the Dead Sea Scrolls, of which there are a lot. This theory I've just given makes a lot of sense for various reasons. This happens to be the great scroll of Isaiah, prophet Isaiah. And you know, this has been very, very valuable. There, not only this one, but all of the biblical scrolls have been valuable. Sometimes there's things that's actually left out of the regular Bible. Like the standard Hebrew text has, at one point, a 1 Samuel has, for some reason, the Israelites are mysteriously at war with, what's the king, Nahash the Ammonite. And this is, well, suddenly, why is this kind of baffling? Well, from the Dead Sea Scroll, it's not so baffling because there are a couple of lines about Nahash the Ammonite invading Israel. So at some point, some scribe just lost his place on the page and just left out 3 or 4 lines about Nahash the Ammonite, which we would never know without the Dead Sea Scroll. The quality of the biblical text is another fascinating subject that would certainly make more than one lecture, but that would not, of course, be tonight's lecture. Well, let me stay with this for a minute. There are a lot of Dead Sea Scrolls. Some of them are biblical, the Hebrew Bible. Some of them are interpretations of the Hebrew Bible. And some of them are kind of apocalyptic. And one problem scholars have had is fitting these together with what we know of the Essenes from other sources. Practically everything I've told you about the Essenes up to this point are from primary historians writing in the 1st century AD. And what they say about all the things I just said about the Essenes, well, how does it relate to the contents of these scrolls? Because the people described in these scrolls don't sound too much like the Essenes in Philo and Josephus. And this has exercised a lot of people's minds and a lot of absurd theories or ingenious theories. But you can just get rid of it by going back to this. Well, if you're storing these scrolls, you're burying them reverently because they contain holy names and that sort of thing. It goes without saying, you don't necessarily need to agree or believe in all these scrolls, and they're sometimes contradictory things. Like one of the central things about the Essenes is that they hated the Hasmoneans. Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls have a prayer for King Jonathan, who is one of the Hasmoneans. Well, if they hated them, why do they have this prayer in here? It's baffling if you try to take all the scrolls and make a consistent theory out of it. But if you take all the scrolls and say, you know, they were just, you know, burying these things either out of reverence for the sacred names in them, or possibly they thought someone might take them, interest in them, and dig them up someday. Suddenly it explains. You don't have to like fit all this stuff together in quite the same way, which I can tell you starts sounding very, very contrived. So, Jesus, was he in a scene? Well, I guess we could cut to the chase. There are similarities. Josephus says about the Essenes that they refused to take oaths. They, you know, for their point of view, if they said it was so, it was so. If it wasn't so, it wasn't so. They considered their word as binding as an oath. Well, that resembles a saying of Jesus's in the Gospels. You know, swear not, but let your yes be yes, and let your no be no. It's an interesting echo. What did Jesus believe about the afterlife? Well, it's not really too clear, partly because if you look through the historical Gospels, scholars aren't quite clear what Jesus said versus what was attributed to him later. Another fascinating, intricate subject about which thousands of books have been written. But every once in a while, you get a glimpse of, you know, the rich man in hell and, you know, the poor man and up in heaven and Lazarus's bosom. It looks a little bit like what Josephus says of the Essene views of the afterlife. But the accent in the second sentence is definitely on this. And here's another unfashionable theory at the moment. Again, accent on the possibly. Was Jesus married? Well, there's certainly a lot of people who want to tell you that Jesus was really married, and every week someone comes up with a gospel that says Jesus was married, specifically to Mary Magdalene. Was he? Well, I don't know. These gospels that say he was, again, yet another topic for a lecture in its own right, but all these gospels are pretty late. The oldest gospels don't really have any mention of this. And scholars are inclined, I mean, you know, serious objective scholars are inclined to believe that, no, he probably wasn't, because in the apostles kind of arguing about marriage and this and that about marriage, or the people in the early church were arguing about marriage, and they said, well, you know, the apostles were married, so blah, 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 which is true. Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law in the gospels. But if they were making this argument, you could really blow it away by saying the Lord himself was married, which they don't. It's an argument from silence which is not definitive. So, again, I wouldn't swear to it, but if Jesus wasn't married, and again, it's very much possibly, maybe this would be why. Another perfectly plausible theory, totally speculative, is that he was married and his wife died young. Women died in childbirth, you know, all the time in those days. Maybe he didn't want to talk about it. That is totally speculative, but there's nothing I just said that's not, doesn't fit perfectly in what we know about the times. Well, here's the big difference, right? And this is, for me, the clincher, which is you have this hyper-observant sect. You know, they don't even go to the bathroom on Saturday. And Jesus' attitude toward the law, if not exactly disrespectful, is certainly much more casual. You know, he's there, he's like picking grain, you know, in a wheat field on the Sabbath, and the Pharisees, you know, consider, you know, him to be a blasphemer for doing this. How could you heal a blind man on the Sabbath? I mean, what kind of monster are you? His attitude toward the law, and it's so central in Jesus' teaching that, you know, the law is made for man, and it's he doesn't necessarily violate it or contradict it, but his attitudes toward the law were much more flexible and much more liberal than that of any of the three Jewish sects. And that's the chief sources of the arguments in the Gospels. So it would be hard for Jesus to be an Essene in any pure sense if he really felt that way. Now, because of the similarities, again, I want to underline this is totally speculative, it is possible that, you know, he was a young man at some point. You know, he may have gone to an Essene school for been part of a community for a few years and decided, you know, to break with it. the point where he, learned some things and accepted some things from them and rejected others. I mean, you have to admit, if nothing else, Jesus was, a highly creative and original religious thinker. So again, this is perfectly plausible. Again, I am not claiming any of this beyond the very basic things that are up on the screen are much more than speculative. But it doesn't really seem too likely that he was in a scene if they had that much of a major difference for him. Well, did the Essenes in that case, are they, because we do see the Pharisees and the Sadducees in the New Testament. Jesus is always arguing with them. But we don't see him arguing with the Essenes, which would lead people to believe maybe he really was an Essene. But there is one a scholar at the University of London who has this particular theory, which is kind of interesting. The Herodians. There is no sect known as the Herodians from that time. People, scholars think, well, maybe they were people who thought King Herod was the Messiah, which is, considering what King Herod was like, not really too plausible. All sorts of theories about it. Well, one thing you will remember is that King Herod was really good to the Essenes and really favored them. So it is arguable that this is who we're talking about. Now, the Essenes would not call themselves Herodians, but it could be a derogatory name applied by somebody else for them. Just, as 100 years ago, the typical Protestant would call the Catholics Papists or Romanists. That was a word applied to them. But no Catholic then or now would call himself a Papist or Romanist. So is this really a reference to the Essenes who, they're arguing because Jesus is not as fastidious about the law as they are. Well, we know the Essenes are very fastidious about the law. So this is, I think this is a very plausible theory. I wrote this a couple of days ago, and yesterday, in a book, I came across a reference to some reference to a Jewish catacomb that mentions that with an inscription in Rome, as a matter of fact, that mentions an inscription says the synagogue of the Herodians. Was there a sect really called the Herodians who called themselves Herodians? That would be one of the very few pieces of evidence that there was. And even that could still be a derogatory nickname. Just as a way, someone would write like a Popish church or something on the wall of a Catholic church if they didn't like the Catholics. So, what happened to them? Well, this is the great turning point. The Jewish War, or as the Jews called it, the Roman War. Herod built that magnificent temple. That was the thing he most was most noted for in Jerusalem. He restored the Temple of Solomon and gone through a couple of iterations between then and his time. This was an incredibly lavish affair. According to Josephus, there were even golden spikes on the roof to keep birds from perching and crapping on the roof. Everything was overlaid with gold and silver. Herod started it in 23 BC, and there was so much work, and it didn't get finished until 64 AD. And it put a lot of people out of work, and this led to social unrest, and this led the Jews to revolt for Rome, and this led the Romans to invade Judea and destroy the temple. So not only was the temple no sooner completed than it was destroyed, but in a way, its completion led to destruction and one of the many ironies of history. The only fragment, the only part of the temple left is the Wailing Wall, which we've all, I don't have a picture of it here, but you've all seen it. It's a retaining wall only. It's still an object of incredible devotion for pious Jews. This is the Arch of Titus, which is still standing. Although the temple destroyed, the monument commemorating its destruction is still alive and well in the Roman Forum, or as an entrance to the Roman Forum. This is it. This is a nice little photo, but the most interesting part of it is blocked by this tree. And here it is, again, rather blurry. Here is a synagogue, menorah, the seven-branch candelabrum in the temple. And these are the, this is a triumphal procession after Titus, the Roman general, destroyed the temple and conquered Judea. You know, they had a triumph, which was an enormous festival parade, and this arch was built to commemorate it. And this was, you know, one of the things they took from the temple. And at that point, Jewish history, as we know it, goes into a major break. It was actually destroyed in, the temple was destroyed in 70, but I'm not going to go into the details of that, but the temple was destroyed in AD 70, and it is a source of grief to Jews. Titus was the general under whom it was destroyed. If you see his name in the Talmud, it will usually be followed by the phrase, "May his bones be ground to dust." So Titus, for obvious reasons, did not have a very affectionate place in the memory of the Jews. And after this, all of this suddenly stops. The old theory was that Judea was completely depopulated. Everybody's either killed or enslaved. This may not have been totally true, but a lot of people were killed and enslaved. And after that point, although the Essenes kind of vanished, fade away. I think there are indications that they still survived into the second century AD. You know, they're very faint and they seem to have petered out. Oh, by the way, here's a bust of Josephus, who wrote the Jewish War, the history of that period, which is a source of a lot of the information I've just given you. He was a leader of the revolt against Rome, but he changed his mind, luckily for him, and became a traitor, and went over. And the general who was fighting at the time was Vespasian, and Josephus, in an almost Essene-like way, predicted that Vespasian would become emperor, which he did. And Josephus was honored and even took the family name of Titus and Vespasian, Flavius Josephus. He was not a very good man. But he writes this all very objectively, and if we'd not have his writings, we'd know very, very, very little about that whole period. I think his history, you know, is generally considered fairly reliable. He's the only non-Christian author in the first century AD to mention Christ. I think I mentioned that in a talk here, Theosophist, but he does make a reference, and he does say that one of them is that, well, such and such a priest had James, the brother of Jesus, who is called the Christ, stoned. So let's see, that it? Yeah, more or less. So that's kind of the history of the Essenes in any kind of real sense. I will talk for a couple of minutes about kind of their survival in memory. I didn't know if I would have time for this, so I didn't do any slides about it. Did the Essenes survive? Well, there's not really any evidence for it. G.I. Gurdjieff, the spiritual teacher, said he met someone or some people in the Middle East who claimed to be descendants of the Essenes or part of the school of the Essenes that had survived. You know, that would have been, I don't know, 1890 or something like that. Is that true? Well, he's probably telling the truth in that he probably did meet someone who did claim to be the heir of the Essenes. Whether they were or not, how you would trace that back to, you know, is anybody's guess. But yeah, there probably are people out there, or there were, you know, who may have claimed some kind of descent from the Essenes, spiritual descent from the Essenes. The other thing that people associate the Essenes with is sprouted bread. You know, you'll sometimes see at health food stores, Essene sprouted bread. This all comes from a book called The Essene Gospel of Peace by a man named Edward Sekely, who claimed he got this Essene Gospel piece from a manuscript he found in the Vatican. And there he has a, you know, kind of a directions for making sprouted bread. No serious scholar believes that this was really written by the Essenes or is ancient. And you know, if you read it, it's like, well, if you're going to write a gospel, here's, you know, you write a gospel. What do? Well, you sort of take everything you remember about from the Gospels. You don't have to remember it all that well. It may be even better if you don't remember it too well. Kind of jumble it all together in a mishmash. You know, maybe throw a bit about light and love in it. And of course, you know, if you want to prove that Mary Magdalene was married to Jesus, you stick that in. If you want to prove that Essenes were vegetarians and ate sprouted bread, you stick that in. And that's probably pretty much what Sekely's book was about. But it's had an enormous amount of influence. And the Essenes, you know, did do some kind of medicinal salts and drugs. I think the minerals of the Dead Sea are still considered to be of high therapeutic value. But the sprouted bread, they probably did not do. I can't resist adding this detail. Ezekiel 4:9 bread. Anyone like Ezekiel 4:9 bread? Well, if you read Ezekiel 4:9, it does in fact give the ingredients that are used to make Ezekiel 4:9 bread. But that's the ingredients only. The recipe goes on, and Ezekiel 4:9 says, 13 says you should cook it with human dung. Whether the Essene Ezekiel 4:9 bread company actually follows that, I don't really know. Probably, in all fairness, Ezekiel probably meant that using human dung as a fuel rather than as an ingredient, which people did in those days. But I have to say, I find that very funny. I actually never really cared for Ezekiel 4:9 bread even before I learned that fun fact, but many people like it. There are some good sprouted breads out there. Essene or not. Okay, well, that's about the end of my spiel. But, you know, we have quite a bit of time, so I'm perfectly happy to chat with you about any points. John has to give you the microphone for the sake of our viewers far afield.
Yes. I was wondering if you could address the copper scroll that was found with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and why would the Essenes, who were, you know, not very focused on material things, would have a scroll like that with the information in it about all the treasures?
I don't know, I mean, frankly. The copper scroll is a very, very big scroll written on copper, which they somehow managed to unroll, although it was apparently not easy. And mostly what it is this is a list of treasure, a staggering amounts, staggering, unbelievable amounts of gold and silver that are supposedly buried somewhere. The question is not only what the Essenes had to do with it, does this possibly have any literal meaning at all? You know, because it's like, you know, the amounts of gold and silver you're talking about, like preternatural, I suppose you're supposed to say. So, no, I don't know. But if it's a Geniza, you know, what they're doing is they're just taking these things and burying them and preserving them. So they don't necessarily have to believe any of what's on any of the things that are in it. That would be the short answer. Anyone else?
Were they teachers or did people follow them? What was their, how did they appeal to the non-Essene crowd or populations or groups, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I don't know entirely. I mean, two obvious things are the great draw to the Essenes was their incredibly high reputation for integrity in their way of life. That in itself kind of would draw proselytes. Going back to Herod, the Essenes were the only people he didn't make take an oath of allegiance, you know, because, you know, he trusted their word. So, you know, that and their, you know, their lifestyle, their rigorous purity, in the sense that was understood in those days, were certainly a major draw. But I think they did teach. And, you know, I think with a lot of these communities, it's probably not all that different than it is today, where you have kind of a core of people who are really, you know, shall we say, in the ashram, and then there are various others who are kind of an outer circle who, you know, kind of come a little less often or a little less committed and, you know, sometimes, you know, are source of support in various ways, both social and financial. But yeah, I think they did teach. I think certainly, I mean, in some ways, when they talk about the sects of the Jews, they weren't quite like religious denominations as we think of them today, although they did have differences. It's more, they had their different interpretations of the law. They all believed in the law, Torah, the Old Testament, but, you know, they took it in different ways. You know, some of it, some of them with a greater degree of literalness than others, and they would have certainly taught that view as well.
I once heard Robert Bly talk about the Essenes and Jesus, and his take on it was that Jesus was initiated by them probably when he was a teenager, during that time when he kind of disappears. Mm-hmm. After he was 12 and before he began to preach. Mm-hmm. And that the Essenes taught Jesus his, quote, magic, turning water into wine, healing, and so forth. So I wonder what you think about that.
Well, all of that is pretty consistent with the picture here. As I said, you know, Jesus could have been with the Essenes. He could have been initiated. The only thing you really have to underline about, you know, what Bly says is that this is very, very, very speculative. I mean, you know, if you're a theosophist, you may, you know, go back and check the Akashic records, assuming you know how to do that, and come up with what you come up with. But in terms of the actual hard evidence, none of that is there. Now, it is true that the Essenes were kind of, they're mostly characterized in terms of prophecy and divination more than, you know, we think of as occult magic. But there's no reason they couldn't have practiced it. All that sort of thing was very, very common. I mean, there are huge numbers of little inscriptions, you know, Christian and non-Christian, Jewish, all sorts with, you know, various incantations on it. Probably a higher proportion than one might like, seem to be curses of one sort or another. So it is possible. And, you know, the other thing to bear in mind with Jesus and that whole is there was a world of traveling wonder workers and magi that ran around the Roman world, the Hellenistic world. Now, it goes without saying, if people are anything like with then were or anything like they are now, probably a good measure were frauds, or, you know, they had like, you know, one or two tricks that, you know, they could pull off. There probably were a few genuine wise men in there, you know, to what extent Jesus was part of that is discussed. Morton Smith, who's a pretty well respected scholar, actually wrote a book on the subject called Jesus the Magician, which he sees Jesus pretty much in that way. So the only time Jesus is ever portrayed as writing something is when he writes something on sand, I think before he, I forget exactly who he's either heals someone or does something, or you know, and you know, some people have speculated, well, that was kind of like a magical incantation, magical sigil. So I mean, it's possible, you know, there's nothing that, you know, raises huge bells, but you know, there's a big step between that and, you know, this is how it was. If you believe the chronology of the gospel according to Luke, Jesus was actually 23 when he started his public career. So his secret years would have been a little bit shorter. Now, again, scholars are not terribly convinced by that, but that's, if you take the gospel of Luke literally, he's the only one who actually tries to fix Christ's life in any sort of date that relates to anything that we can figure out. You know, he was born in 6 AD 6, and he started to preach in 29. That would make him 23. Makes it seem a little different, you know. I mean, again, that's another quite controversial subject. So.
Oh, there was someone wrote in a question. Did the Essenes require baptism?
Not to my knowledge. And kind of the question behind that was, probably, was John the Baptist an Essene? Because that's frequently kind of assumed or stated. I don't know, from what, you know, judge for yourself. I mean, the Essenes they're like the people I described here. John the Baptist is kind of this wild figure in the wilderness, kind of a prophetic voice that doesn't look too much like this. John the Baptist, obviously, you know, and he may quite consciously model himself on the prophet Elijah in the Old Testament, who was pretty much like John the Baptist. He, you know, wore animal skins and lived in the desert and that kind of thing. There is the argument, which one could get into, that, you know, well, did Jesus say that John was actually the reincarnation of Elijah? Some people will argue that, also speculatively. But did they practice baptism? They had a very, very elaborate ritual purifications, which were part of the Jewish custom anyway. Like, you had to go through this ritual purification. I don't know why the subject keeps coming up, but it does every time you went to the bathroom. You know, and Josephus says, well, this is a little weird since it is actually a natural thing, but they still do it. So they had so many ablutions that, you know, probably they weren't going to pay too much enormous attention to, like, one big one. So, Augie, we're going to...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about John the Baptist, but how about Mary, his mother? Do you read much about whether she was associated with that, the virgin birth and everything?
Well, Mary is actually a pretty shadowy figure in the New Testament itself. And she appears mostly in the Gospel of Luke. And some people the old tradition was that Luke got used Mary as a source. Because, you know, it's talking about her. There's not a lot of similarity between them. I mean, she wouldn't have been, it's hard to see how she would have been part of the community. You know, she's a shadowy figure. I mean, in the other Gospels, Jesus is frankly mostly just kind of rude to her. You know, your brother and your brothers and your mother are outside, you know, they want to see you, let them wait. I mean, he practically says that at one point. The devotion to Mary really only started to pick up, you know, in the third and fourth centuries. And for an interesting little fact I can throw at you, Mary was proclaimed the Mother of God officially and formally by the Catholic and Orthodox churches in 430 AD. And ironically, this was... 4 years, or not ironically, but significantly, it was 4 years after the pagan temples were all ordered to be closed. And the great worship, I mean, the most popular goddess by far in late antiquity was Isis. And it's very, very plausible to think that, well, there's all this Isis devotion, and let's figure out a way to transplant it to the Virgin. But we are talking, you know, like 400 years after Jesus' life. So, but I don't know of anything that, you know, but okay.
Someone has written in a question. Thanks for this great lecture, Mr. Richard. An archaeologist friend of mine said to me once that one of the secrets of longevity of the Essenes was an expression like honey within, oil without. I'm not sure if this is an accurate translation. Have you come across this phrase among from your research?
No, but I wouldn't be surprised if it came from the Essene Gospel of Peace, which has a lot of kind of health things about it as well. That would be my guess. Which, you know, again, was probably written by, you know, this Hungarian in the 1920s. So. However inspiring and useful it may be, apart from that.
I have read that at the time of Jesus, there were a lot of proclamations about the end times, and he was kind of one of those apocalyptic preachers. Is there anything in the Essene information that you found about you know, proclaiming the end times?
Well, it's a tricky question. And the reason it's a tricky question is there is a lot in the Dead Sea Scrolls talking about just that. The question then becomes how much of the Essenes, of the Dead Sea Scrolls are Essene? You know, to what extent are they just, you know, we don't want this to be desecrated because it has God's name in it, so we're going to bury it. And to what extent they actually believe. There is an enormous amount in there. I mean, apocalyptic expectation was very, very intense, and always became incredibly intense. And the major works of apocalypse, that is, books about the end of the world in the Bible, were written at times when the Jews were very, very threatened. You remember when Antiochus Epiphanes put the image in the temple? I talked about that. That was when the book of Daniel was written, between 167 and 164 BC. And Daniel says, well, you know, once this, the abomination of desolation, you know, which the idol or whatever it was, is cleared out, you know, the dead shall rise up to judgment. Scholars can actually date that book because, well, what happened was, no, the dead didn't actually rise, the world didn't end, the Jews just drove out Antiochus Epiphanes and, you know, put in this not that great dynasty of their own. I mean, the book of Revelation is arguably, at least partly, written during the Jewish War. You know, it's you know, a time when things were looking pretty bad. And even Jesus' own predictions in the Gospels, in what is called the apocalyptic discourse, you know, if you read it without too much, you know, really trying to read what it's actually saying. I mean, it sounds like he's predicting a Roman invasion, the destruction of the temple, followed by the end of the world. Did he really predict this? Is this a prophecy that was sort of put on him? It couldn't have been written too much later than the Jewish War, because the world obviously didn't end. But that's why people date the Gospels to that period. Could Jesus have predicted it? Yeah. I mean, things were pretty bad in Judea in his time. I mean, things were really tense. I mean, you know, you didn't have to have too much supernatural ability to think, this is going to get bad. This is really going to blow up. But apocalypse is, I mean, it is a fascinating subject. A lot of it has to do with what is called theodicy, the question of the justice of God. Because, hey, you know, I mean, it started with the Jews. You know, we're the chosen people. I mean, you know, we've kind of done some bad things. We can't have been that bad. You know, the idea is eventually that, you know, somehow the accounts have to be set right. You know, so, you know, Jerusalem will be exalted and all that kind of thing. Apocalypse is very, very, I mean, it's a lot of things, but one of those is an attempt to, like, account for perceived injustices and imbalances in good and evil in the world. You know, well, we can kind of stand this because in the end, you know, the Messiah or Jesus or whoever will come to set it right. If you're interested, and I don't know if you remember of the TS, I did actually do an article on apocalyptic in the summer issue of Quest, which talks a little bit more about some of these things. So.